artificial intelligence will allow you to do, an agentic AI will allow you to do, is to be able to take from a battery of assets that you've got and show Mongezi or show Jeanette or show Jess exactly the type of relevant content that they need at that moment in time, which is very different to the stuff that AB is going to see.
Culture for us is not a marketing hook. It's not something we just talk about. It's actually in the bones of the business. You know, to put out a trending, you know, thing on TikTok, let's be honest, it's very easy. It's very short-lived, and it would be exhausting to try and build cultural relevance that way. And to be honest, in our experience, you can do a lot of that. It doesn't make people want to come to Nando's anymore.
Welcome to The Lead Creative once again. This is the Marketer's Brief series, where every quarter we talk to CMOs, senior marketers, and brand leaders about some of the pressures, priorities, and decisions they have to make to build brands. I'm your host, Mongezi Mthathi. I co-host the series with the editor of Biz Community, Danette Breitenbach. We're always talking to agencies, so now we're hearing the marketer's perspective, and we are doing so every quarter. In this debut episode, we are joined by the former CEO of Ogilvy South Africa, AB Mokgwatsane, who is the CMO of Investec. We are also joined by Jessica Wheeler, the Chief Brand and Customer Officer of Nando's. We explore their views on building brands, on brand agency partnerships, on what it takes to build a brand without focusing on short-term wins, while building a brand that people love, that resonates.
All a brand does is reflect the culture of the organization. And it's a dynamic process, right? Because some of the stuff that the brand does has and will impact the culture within the organization, just as culture is going to impact the work that the brand does on the outside.
And what are some of the pressures that they are facing? What are their views on AI and everything else that affects brands today?
AI has got no business replacing human creativity. Me personally and Nando's will not permit our agencies to generate creative using AI. Where it is great, though, is to get rid of all the muck that we have to do in between so we can spend more time doing the creative work.
Most importantly, we ask them what it takes to build a brand when there's so much content out there, while not chasing your tail and ensuring that you have really great agency brand partnerships to help you build as you go.
The client's role is to make the complex simple, and the agency's role is to make the simple exciting. It's when we conflate those things that the relationship gets messed up. So my agency experience has certainly helped me understand that and help communicate that to both our agency partners and the people I've worked with.
It's really important to differentiate between, like, really, really giving a damn about culture and hopping onto a social media trend, because those are two very, very different things.
This series is brought to you by The Lead Creative in collaboration with Biz Community, the multi-award-winning integrated agency, Roger Wilco, and our production partners, Soweto Media. Amy, what's the earliest memory that you have of interacting with a brand and realizing that it was marketing? And how do you think that that moment shaped how you think today?
So I grew up in a shop in Winterveld, Pretoria, and my parents had a shop, and we obviously just grew up, and we were part of the staff, really. So I was kind of packing bread at five and trying to sell and work the till. And I realized one day, it was some Christmas, and I made a poster for some tomatoes that were going to be on special. And I was like, okay, this is quite interesting. And I didn't even know what I was doing. But, you know, following that up and saying, look, how many people are going to buy the tomatoes? And I think that was the beginning of my understanding that this is probably the career that I'd end up in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you, Jess?
Oh, my. I have to tell you, I don't have an origin story at all. I never wanted to be in marketing.
Yeah.
I kind of landed here by accident. I wanted to be a doctor. That's what I was going to do. And then I went and studied economics because it felt like the trendy thing to do at the time. And then accidentally landed up in marketing.
And really, now you're doctoring the numbers.
Well,
doing creative accounting.
We need doctors in economics. That's a great journey.
So if we come back to UAB, so that's where you started with the tomatoes. Now you're at Investec.
Yes.
So how do you take a brand like Investec, make sure it's consistent, but stays modern and relevant? How do you manage to do that? Because we live in a very kind of quick, everything's fleeting.
Sure.
So how do you manage a brand like that?
Yeah, I mean, I always tell my teams, and they're absolutely sick of hearing this from me, is try and be freshly consistent, not consistently fresh. I know in the kind of the food world, that doesn't really work. But yeah, I mean, being freshly consistent is about understanding what your principles are. And then finding new and interesting ways of expressing that to match or lead the times in which you belong. So I think the strongest brands are the ones that have a very clear sense of who they are and have built on that consistently over time. It shouldn't be something that is changed by the specific time frame in which you exist. You just adapt that for that market. So I've always gone back to, you know, what is the core? What do we stand for? What are we trying to communicate? And then let the modern times be the filter.
Sounds great. And leads me to you. You've just had a big brand reset.
Yeah.
And an agency change. So can you take us through that a little bit? What led to that? Because Nando's is a consistent brand. It's a very well-known brand in South Africa. It's very loved. How do you decide to do a brand reset and change the agency? It's a very brave thing to do.
Well, I think the first thing is I didn't decide, right? I mean, it's very convenient that the timing happens to be at the same time, but this certainly wasn't a new broom sweep clean kind of scenario. The business has been on that journey for some time before I joined. And actually, you know, AB said it's probably not the same for food, but it's exactly the same, right? Is this return to what made the brand great in the beginning? And I think in many instances, growth and success can lead you away from that. And particularly in a category like ours, where it's hyper competitive. And then we had COVID, you know, the whole category shuts down. You've got to kind of return to, you know, some kind of trading power very quickly. There are all these contextual things that happened that moved us a little bit away from our core. Which made us less competitive over time, which made us, you know, more susceptible to competition entering the market. So it was I keep saying it and it sounds like marketing drivel, but it wasn't a refresh as much as it was a homecoming. Like, let's just take a minute. Let's just go all the way back and let's just go back to what made Nando's successful. And those things have not changed. And the way that I explain it to my team, who obviously many of them have been part of that brand for decades, much longer than I have, is that, you know, the brand consists of two things. It consists of the core and it consists of the costume. We need to go back to the core because it's very easy to start spending a lot of time dressing and doing cool things, particularly with social media. You get caught up in that, like crack cocaine, right? And that kind of brand, it wasn't a repositioning. It was a homecoming. It was like, let's just go back. Let's just take a minute. Importantly, it didn't happen externally until we had gone back for 18 months inside the business and made sure that the experience reflected those same core things that maybe we had lost along the way. So it was inevitable, I think. Call it a midlife crisis. The brand's nearly 40 years old. You know, it wasn't a rash decision because, you know, a new CMO or we're bored or whatever. It was needed because we needed to go back to the things that made Nando's great in the first place.
As brands become more successful, as brands grow, they also become safer. They also kind of, I think to your point, that it's about going back to the core. Yeah. What are some of the deliberate decisions that you have to make as a brand as you grow to maintain your distinctiveness as you scale? In our previous conversation, we spoke about the fact that we experience Nando's differently here than someone in London, for instance, but the core is true.
Yeah.
What are some of these distinctive decisions that you make, these decisions rather that you make to remain distinctive, to stay with your core, even though the costume and the crack cocaine of social media tells you that you are cool because of X or Y?
Yeah, it is hard work. And I think it's probably 90% of of the job of, you know, the leader of that marketing is not necessary to have those, you know, those hard discussions with your teams or your agencies, but the rest of the business, you know, who may not understand the context, where it's really easy to do something against your core and, you know, for great returns and quick transaction growth and great market share growth immediately. But over time, that's going to, that's going to cost you, right? There's a long-term cost to those things. So it is a lot of hard conversations, but I think from a marketing point of view, we have a responsibility to get people to understand why and to, yes, there's a short-term benefit from, but what's the long-term cost? And to actually quantify that, because as soon as you can do that, then all of a sudden you have finance people, a franchise system, ops leaders, restaurant managers understanding that, you know, a quick win tomorrow against your core and your values and the things that you believe in as a business that have built this business over 38 years, in the long run, it's going to eventually lead to your demise. You've got to be practical about it, but it's a lot of hard conversations, particularly when the economy is tough.
AB, Jessica talks about these short-term wins sometimes in the market. The industry has been under fire for the past couple of years for short-termism, both agency and the brand side of things. And in financial services and every other industry, but financial services specifically, there's this quarterly results, this thing, you know, all of these things that come with all the risks. How do you weigh what to do or how to react in an industry that seems to be measuring itself on a quarterly basis when you're building a brand long-term?
Yeah, I mean, you know, similar to Jess, I love the reference to homecoming. Interestingly, you know, the Investec business was founded long before the zebra as its icon or out of the ordinary as our payoff line. I mean, that, you know, and it's interesting to go back to the journey around how we started. I mean, Stephen Kosoff tells the story around how he was having meetings in New York with Bernard Kanter, and they went into the Four Seasons for a meeting, and he came out of that Four Seasons in New York and he says, we should be the Four Seasons of banking in wherever we operate. So that was the beginning and the establishment of our service culture. And that is what eventually led to, and service within the financial services industry being at such a high level was something that was out of the ordinary. So our brand was almost born out of the business model of the organization and the founders. And the way that we deal with short-termism is we just go back again to the business model core. We go back to the brand core, which is around service, which is about being out of the ordinary, being distinctive, caring about the people that are inside the organization as much as you care about the clients that are outside of it. Those are, you know, tenants that are going to be with us for a long time. And whenever we feel that there's been a bit of a shift in market and we're losing a bit of focus, that's what we go back to. And our investors and our shareholders understand that that's our secret sauce, and they hold us accountable to keeping that going. So I think just be clear about what you stand for and reinvent that and how you express that as your success. And that's worked well for us.
Baby, tell me your background in agency. How do you feel that contributes to help you in the role of a marketer? Does it or not?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting because I'd overlay that with something else. Is I've never worked in a similar industry. You know, so I started my career at VWV, which is an experiential agency. I mean, back then it was kind of doing events and websites, and then I went to SAB, which as an, you know, sold a lot of beer. And then I went back to VWV. Then after that, I went back into agency world, into kind of Ogilvy, then to Vodacom, then to Investec. So, you know, I've worked in different industries and I've realized that that's when I've been hired or when I've been attractive to people, it's been because they want someone that hasn't done this job before in this industry. So they're looking for some sort of change. So I think my context always has always been, you know, be humble enough to understand that you actually don't know what's going on, but be courageous enough to learn on the job and apply what you do know. So my experience, to get to your question around coming from an agency environment and now working inside a corporate, is that it's just made me even more empathetic than I think I naturally was. Being in the agency environment, I saw clients blame too much on the agency relationship. And that was something that I always thought was completely wrong. You know, I mean, like, no ad goes out, no agency gets anything wrong if the client hasn't completely messed it up. You know, you only do work that the client has signed off. So it's really helped me with, you know, creating more empathy and more patience of my teams and actually getting clients in all the environments that I've worked in to do the work. So much has been delegated to agencies. Strategy has been delegated to agencies. Far too much strategy has been delegated to agencies. So those are the two big things. One, patience. And the other is, like, if you do the work, let the agency do what they're great at. You know, the client's role is to make the complex simple. And the agency's role is to make the simple exciting. And it's when we conflate those things that the relationship gets messed up. So my agency experience has certainly helped me understand that and help communicate that to both our agency partners and the people I've worked with.
Jessica, I see you're nodding in agreement there. And I did want to ask you as well, how do you view the relationship between marketer and agency? Because it's a relationship that's a lot being said about it. And there's a lot of stuff being thrown out around it. So how do you view that relationship?
I mean, I have very, very similar points of view. You know, I worked in exclusively agency for 20 years before somehow somebody gave me a job at Nando's. And it's exactly that. It's having an appreciation for what agencies need to get the job done to the best that they can do it, and how, and being firsthand witness to how bad it can be when it's not like that, right? And I think, and we have very, very similar points of view, is that I always fight with people and they say, you know, the agencies need to understand your business. No, they don't. That is my job and my team's job, is to understand the business. The agency understand people, that, because I don't have the time. My team is in an office, they're in a spreadsheet, they're in the Nando's bubble all day, every day. Mm. They're our touch points with the people that we need to buy from. So it is just absolutely this understanding of how to get the best work out. And I think on the flip side, also an understanding of, you know, we know what skeletons are in the closets. It's very hard to build a marketer if they've come from an agency point of view, because, but almost by the time it gets there's something else that's too far gone. You know, if you're starting to have to question those things, but just giving creative people the freedom that they need, because you've lived that reality and you know how rubbish it can be when it doesn't work that way.
I think I'll come in with a bit of a follow-up to that. Mm-hmm. In fact, to both of you, because of this experience from agency, starting with you, Jess, I think one of the things that come up for me is the trust, firstly, and secondly, the understanding the business portion, because as agency folk, we are always told that you don't understand my business enough. We don't do this. We don't react like that. We are not, you know, all of these things that are actually in the very same documents that we get when being briefed on this business the first time and onboarded, right? So the question then is, do you find that you are more trusting of the agency because of that background? And do you also find that you offer more guidance on understanding the business better for the agency? Because one of the things that agencies that we've spoken to that have won awards from Cannes to everywhere else say, cite trust. Yeah. They keep saying, it's because the client trusted us. It's because of the trust that we're able to do these things. Do you think you're more trusting of the agency? And how does that translate into the relationship and the work?
Yeah, I think you trust people, not agencies, right? Because it's very hard to trust an entity. So I think the best relationships and the best working relationships when you work with people that you like, right? And that's not even from a personal point of view. It's, you know, you can like people who challenge you in the right ways and who respect your domain and you respect their domain. That's how you build trust. You know, trust isn't necessarily built over tenure. So, you know, just because you've had an agency for 20 years, that doesn't mean that you can trust them any more than us, an agency we've had for a couple of months. So it does come with meeting each other in the middle and respecting what each of you brings to the table. You know, it isn't a point where it's like, I think Heidi Brower says, you know, it's parent-child. If it starts getting like that, it gets very mucky. Like, you don't hire an agency to listen to your instruction. You don't pay for an echo. Yeah. You know, you're doing yourself a disservice. What you're paying for is somebody to see it from a different point of view, which is even more reason why your agency shouldn't be in the muck of your business, because they are just going to get the same thing that you get. And yes, you have really rubbish days and you have, you know, lots of reporting and all sorts of things. And that stuff will start impacting your point of view and your vision on the world and your take on things. Let them be independent. Let them look from an outside point of view, because they will always have this amazing, refreshing perspective. And then take it on yourself as marketing people. And if you're part of a marketing team, is take all that, to AB's point, absolutely take all that complexity, strip it out, hand it over to them and let them do their job.
Yeah. AB, you mentioned that you've handed over a lot more of the strategy to the agency as well. How does that level of trust, I suppose, in your space, again, Investec is in South Africa and overseas as well. Again, you said we experience the brand differently here than they do, say, someone in London experiences it once again, right? So how has handing over strategy so much and that trust translated into the kind of work that you do?
Yeah, well, I mean, the point I was making is that clients have handed over too much strategy into the agency environment. And that's completely wrong. You know, understanding your business and understanding the market and the competitive set takes a lot of work and understanding and patience from the people that are inside the organizations. I mean, that's what we spend most of our time doing. That's what the CEO does. He's trying to understand how this machine works so that he can make it as competitive as possible against other people who've also got some really good and strong machines in a very dynamic market. So there's a lot of work that I think clients have abdicated to agencies where actually they haven't done enough homework on their business and their context. So I think it's very important that clients kind of get back and own the agency. It's not to say that own the strategy. It's not to say that agencies can't contribute and enrich that process and come with their own frameworks. That's very good. But the core of the agency ownership has to be, of the strategy ownership has to be within the client environment. I think in terms of building trust, you know, empathy goes a long way. You know, I think that from an agency perspective, look, you don't necessarily know how to develop and write derivatives, right? Mm. But you do need to know why a bank looks at return on equity. You need to know what client loss ratio is going to be. You need to understand those basics in how a bank or wealth manager or financial services work. In the same time, as a marketing team, you need to understand how the agency world works.
Yes.
How do they manage costs? What are their pressures? How do they manage people? What kind of people work in the agency environment? What do they find competitive? You know, how do they compete with each other? And what do they think great looks like? And that builds a lot of trust. So there's a process of learning from each other. Julian Ribeiro used to, at Ogilvy, used to have this process called Red Hot Briefs, where whenever there was a big brief or a massive campaign, he would get the agency and the client teams to get together and write it together. So the clients present the strategy, the creative team in the agencies kind of present some creative ideas, but they come together and they write what the brief is together that's going to go into the agency environment. I think that was a great idea. I mean, that's something that I think we should be doing a lot more of, is work on stuff together, but with very clear tramlines around who does what and who's good at what. Too many clients think they're creative.
Maybe I want to stay with you and I want to stay with inside the organization. You're a very strong advocate for a strong corporate culture as a foundation for the brand.
Yeah.
Can you take us through that thinking? I find it very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, like I said earlier, that our founders built a very strong business under very core principles around service. We're a very egalitarian organization, so high degrees of access. I mean, we had open plan offices in 1978, right? That was before it was even a thing. Like, we didn't have walls. I started working at SAP in 2000 and they had walls and offices back then. We used to have to wear ties. So, you know, that's just the culture of the organization. And I think all a brand does is reflect the culture of the organization. And it's a dynamic process, right? Because some of the stuff that the brand does has and will impact the culture within the organization, just as culture is going to impact the work that the brand does on the outside. So I work very closely with our head of people, with Leslie Ann Gatter, and we understand that we are two sides of the same, two different sides of the same coin. We do a lot of work together. They see all the work that we are about to do. They're buying to all the work that we're doing. We obviously manifest all the internal work that that we're doing, and it just makes for a stronger brand expression when you get out there. You know, our people really love seeing the work that we do out there because they've bought into it, they understand it, and it's reflective of them.
So Jessica, staying with culture rather, Nando's is often seen as a cultural leader. Mm. It doesn't just reflect the culture, it is often the culture. Mm. How do you do that with a brand? How do you ensure that your people inside live the brand as well, and that we all feel that way about Nando's as if it's part of us, you know?
Yeah. I think, you know, there's often a misconception, and people interchange culture and trends, right? I think a lot of our kind of cultural credibility often stems from, oh, we saw that tactical post you did on that thing. And people are like, oh, look, you're hot in culture. And I'm like, no, that's not really it. You know, it's great, but that's the costume, right? And I think, you know, from being culturally relevant, you can't do that for a long time unless it's part of the core part of your brand, right? And you, because when it's part of the core part of the brand, and particularly at a place like Nando's where the brand is the business, and similarly, if our internal people don't believe it, there's no hope in hell anybody else is going to do it. But when it's part of the core of the brand, then the way you do business reinforces it. So if we look at creativity as one of the things that are so important to us, it is not something that we use as a hook in marketing to get people to think we're cool. It's part of how we do business. So we know that the better we do at business, the more restaurants we have to open, the more local art we can purchase, the more local furniture makers and designers we can employ to be able to fill out those stores. So it becomes this amazing shared value thing. So it's not a culture for us. It's not a marketing hook. It's not something we just talk about. It's actually in the bones of the business. You know, to put out a trending, you know, thing on TikTok, let's be honest, it's very easy. It's very short-lived, and it would be exhausting to try and build cultural relevance that way. And to be honest, in our experience, you can do a lot of that. It doesn't make people want to come to Nando's anymore. You know, people will love Nando's because of the spectacle on social media, but not love us enough to come and buy us. Mm. That's a big problem, because that's what pays my salary. You know, so it's really important to differentiate between, like, really, really giving a damn about culture and hopping onto a social media trend, because those are two very, very different things.
But you guys have done it so well. Like, the way that Nando's is able to comment and be a commentator of stuff that is happening in everyday life in such a relevant, often humorous way is, I think, a real gem. Mm.
But I think we're able to do that because embedded in the business, we're contributing back, right? So it's not done as a way to, you know, that's hollow.
It's
literally because, and again, it's over time. It's over 38 years being able to say, cool, we can have a point of view, and we can have a controversial take on things, but it's because every day we get up and we do contribute back.
Mm. You have that was one of my questions, the young designers. Mm. Competition. Yeah. Just because I'm interested how that brand or how that program contributes to the brand. And I think it follows on from what you're saying.
It's exactly what it is. I mean, and you'll never see a Nando's ad campaign about hot young designers, because it's not a marketing initiative. Mm. It's part of the business. So literally hot young designers is, you know, identifying that particularly in South Africa, that it's very difficult for young designers to get a foot in the door. There's this huge capital requirement. You've got to know somebody who knows somebody. Just to be able to manufacture at scale is really, really expensive. So Hot Young Designers gives us the opportunity to go and find young and upcoming, you know, whether they be furniture maker, pattern makers, lighting, you know, people who are designing lighting fixtures, and put them into the Nando system, which gives them scale. It gives them mentorship. It gives them access to literally thousands of restaurants around the world who are obligated to purchase from that catalog. So it kind of gives them, we call it hand ups, not handouts. So bring them into the system. It makes a difference. It means that they can make a meaningful living off their craft, which is really, really important for us. but we don't use it in our advertising because our advertising is to sell chicken, right? So we're not going to, it's not going to be like some tacky marketing hook.
I want to stick with this idea of culture. And I think something that we spoke about, I think last time as well, but with a bit of a caveat. So on this idea of culture, brands tend to want to emulate the costume, as you put it, of what Nando's does and how Nando's is. Whereas you go at it from the core, you build it from the core. It's not about the costume. In fact, there was some talk around the industry around, is that new Nando's at Nando's? You know, because we're expecting a certain Nando's thing, which is, that's not necessarily who you are. You are a lot more than that as a brand. Where do marketers get it wrong when trying to emulate culture?
Well, I think the important thing is you should get it wrong often, right? Mm. But you should be smart enough to learn from it eventually. And similarly, we get it wrong very often, and we got it wrong for quite some time. And we eventually realized, that costume, which is almost the surface level thing, is very easy to attach yourself to. It's very, it's fun. Guess what? You get thousands of likes and shares, which are all great for your ego and all those kinds of things. But at the point where it doesn't start translating into long-term equity or sales in the short term, then you start realizing, hang on a second, the costume is actually, it's a little bit of an anchor around our neck now. We've created this monster with these huge expectations, you know. Now we don't even have to say anything because people are like, oh, I wonder what Nando's is going to say. Or they make it themselves. I mean, so sometimes do some very bad, bad results. But the truth of it is that eventually that costume becomes really heavy for you to wear all the time. Mm. And you spend so much time, money, focus, resources, dressing up the costume that you don't have enough to invest in the core. Mm. And I think when it starts, when that kind of pendulum swings, then you're doing it wrong and you should stop and you should pull back. We all want to be entertained. Absolutely do the entertaining work, but remember that there is a part of your job that requires you to make transactional information entertaining as well, which is the harder thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Much.
Maybe I want to stick with this idea of setting and starting a trend that an industry kind of tends to follow.
Yeah.
Investec has been very deliberate in terms of where you invest, what you sponsor, the events that you do, and everything else, right? So what tends to happen when, I think Seth Godin in another episode says, the moment you get it right, everybody else does the same thing, right? So so how do you get it right in terms of setting the scene, setting the tone, when the market copies, you maintain your authenticity without now looking as, you know, another has-been or another person who's running the same race as them?
I mean, look, I mean, that's a very live conversation now. If you think about private banking, there are a lot of financial services businesses that have got private banking offerings. There's a lot of awards that you can win for, being private bank of the year. I mean, obviously, we set the business model up right in the beginning. And it's a very successful business model, right? It's like, how can you hyper-personalize a service to a very niche audience and deliver exceptional service levels to those that particular audience and drive loyalty in that way? And if it works, people are going to be like, we should try and do the same thing. And what we find is that when people get to experience the difference, it's clear what the benchmark is, and most people will then choose accordingly. So I think if you are good at something, try and be the best at as possible and keep doing that as long as you can. That's where your energy is going to come from, and that's our focus. So we stick to our knitting and we evolve what it means to be a private bank and wealth manager. We are known for our excellent service, so we are always investing in that. And it doesn't matter how much money another organization have. You can never, you can't just recreate. You can't create that service culture. It's in the water. Do you know what I mean? Like it's in the way that our receptionists will greet you as you come in to the office. It determines that whenever we have a client function, that when you come to a staff function, you're not going to feel like you're in the back room there just because it's a staff event. You feel the experience, and you know that you're a respected member of the community just as much as we respect our clients. So there's certain things that you can try and emulate and present and try and copy. But, you know, in the end, if you just stick to your knitting and you evolve that offering, it should see you through.
You mentioned hyper-personalization.
Yeah.
I think lastly, I want to just get into that because
we
give brands a lot of our data, right? My medical aid, I'm looking at you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like all these brands, my bank, my medical aid.
Yes.
Every place, my gym, and they think they are hyper-personalizing and yet they are just spamming me. How do you get hyper-personalization right?
Look, I mean, I think technology has allowed us to be a lot more effectively hyper-personalized.
Yeah.
I think a lot of brands get it wrong because you don't really understand what your strategy is going to be and what you are trying to influence. So the you are driven by the need to hyper-personalize, but you actually don't know what you're trying to get out of it. You don't know what you're trying to learn, and you don't know how to present yourself with empathy to those clients. I mean, you know, the way that we think about it is because we were born out of a private banking organization. I mean, we actually started off initially selling medical equipment to doctors. To specialists, right? Because it's like, it's quite an expensive thing to set up when you're going to go and set up a practice. You're a dentist and you kind of need those fancy machines that do the x-rays and so on. It costs a lot of money. And what we bumped into is like, geez, okay, these doctors and specialists, they're slightly different to the accountant guys and they're slightly different to the lawyer guys. So we put specific teams around those. We wrapped their experience and their context we wrapped the service around their experience. Mm. So all that technology is helping us do is just do that at scale.
Mm.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's where we started. We started off trying to hyper-personalize in the first place. And that's what's helped us.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the risk is, you know, getting into the car, getting into a Ferrari, and not really knowing what you want to do with it and how you want the car, to wrap around, you know, the racetrack that you're on. It just helps when you're clear about what your strategy is.
Yeah.
We look at technology.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's a bad thing or if no conversation in 2026 cannot bring in AI. I hate saying it, but there it is. I'm interested in AI in terms of how to fix marketing, how to fix the agency marketing relationship. There's so much being thrown around about how it's affecting agencies, their bottom lines, how we've all got to evolve. So I'd like to know, Jessica, from you and then from you, Abby. How do you see this evolving?
Oh, it's a very big slippery slope. So I'll give you my personal point of view, which does not represent the point of view of Nando's. I think for me, AI has got no business replacing human creativity. And me personally and Nando's will not permit our agencies to generate creative using AI. Where it is great though, is to get rid of all the muck that we have to do in between so we can spend more time doing the creative work, right? And that works both on the agency side and inside in the marketing team, is that when you are putting together reports, so many reports, guys, reports and insights and all sorts of things, AI is a great tool to be able to do the bulk of the work so that you can spend your time applying the human thought to it. From an agency point of view, it could be, you know, solving scheduling, trafficking, you know, those kinds of things. Concept boards, where before, you know, you'd have to go and outsource it to, you know, an illustrator or whatever. And then we wait for 6 weeks for somebody to draw the boards and then they come back. You know, that is a lot more efficient. But it's not efficiency to save costs. It's efficiency to spend your money where you get the best out of people, which is applying their brains. I must just caveat that before everybody on my team gets very excited because they don't have access to the full suite of AI that I do, because particularly with young marketing people, you need to learn by doing. Learning how to write a digital strategy on ChatGPT is the worst thing you can do for your career, because you actually need to know, because if you don't know, you can't interrogate and you're just going to take the outputs, you can be like, cool, it must be right. So I tend to not proliferate AI internally because I still think there's so much people can learn by doing. But there are certainly, in my world, I'm very thankful for AI because it does help me get through a lot of things much faster so that I can spend time doing the things that not only I really want to do, but that everybody gets a lot more value from me doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think if we assume that the product is priced correctly, that it's giving the right level of utility to the clients, the job of marketing is to persuade a prospective client to choose your product over another. So let's assume that you've got that. And I think then the role of marketing is to be able to, as best as possible, hyper-personalize the way that it speaks to you in a way that's going to convince you better than the competitor is going to be. And I think technology has a lot of work and help that it can, you know, that can help do that. I've got a slightly different view to Jess from a creative production perspective. I do think that we produce a lot of content mm-hmm. as brands. You produce content for TV, for radio, for different mediums, for digital. And what artificial intelligence will allow you to do, and agentic AI will allow you to do, is to be able to take from a battery of assets that you've got and show Mongezi or show Jeanette or show Jess exactly the type of relevant content that they need at that moment in time, which is very different to the stuff that AB is going to see. Yeah. And I think that they scale benefits in that. There is going to be an impact in that efficiency and that production because more and more is going to be done by machines. And I think instead of skirting around the issue, what the industry needs to do, and you know, Tim Spira wrote a white paper on AI with Jared Sinman from VML about this. But one of the things that they speak about is that the agency, the marketers and the agency world need to sit together and say, right, this thing is coming. How do we deal with it? How do we make sure that whatever jobs are lost can potentially be replaced or retrained to do other stuff? So I think even in that hyper-personalization holy grail of marketing, we are relying on machines to scale the amount of production that we do and to bring down the cost of that particular production, because you couldn't possibly do that with the existing machine. But a real conversation has to happen. I think there's a big opportunity for agencies, actually. To Jess's point, a lot of companies can't use the total suite of AI tools available because of all the permissions and the, you know, the threat to data fraud mm-hmm. that's going on out there. So, but agencies can. So, you know, agencies have got access to Perplexity, Midjourney, Chat Enterprise, all the tools that are out there. And I think the agency should be getting way ahead. In fact, you guys can run much faster than the client environment. Can you imagine how much faster you can run than a financial institution? Mm. So take the gap. You know, I think there's a similar opportunity that presented itself around kind of the mid-90s, 2000s, where agencies could have just got onto the social media and digital world and just got streets ahead of clients. And I don't think they took that gap. In fact, the people that took the gap are the ones that are behemoths today. It's Meta, it's Alphabet. It's all those kind of digital companies. And I think agencies lost the opportunity there. I'm not sure now if they've got the capital to be able to keep up with those guys, but they can certainly get faster and do more than client environment. So I think there's an opportunity. Yeah. Mm.
There are two questions that come up for me. The first one is a question that Danette and I usually ask in part of this sort of award series that we've been running, right? There's a lot of talk in the industry globally about clients cutting agency rates because of the use of AI. Meanwhile, prior to that, agencies were already saying, we are underpaid. That's why we need to do so many things, right?
Yeah.
At least that's a perception, yes.
Yes.
So, I've never heard that one before.
No, it's like, so it's like we have to chase, it's almost like agencies believed that the ones you spoke to, that we have to chase our tails doing so much because we get very little or little out of the clients that we work for, that we have to chase our tails mm-hmm. constantly doing more and more work for us to stay afloat. That's mm-hmm. at least the perception, right? So I think what technology does is AI gives us more time to think. Yeah. And yet clients are cutting rates when you take some time to
just think when you rebalance
exactly
the
right. That's the first part. The second part is related to this: is how do we bring back time to think in marketing and agencies so that we are able to churn out better quality work rather than just more work?
Yeah. So, look, I mean, the issue around whether agencies are fairly paid or not, I think, is a perennial conversation you're going to have from anyone selling a service to the other person on the other end of that buying the service, whether you're selling chicken or you're selling financial products, right? That's never going to disappear. I think what technology will be able to do is it will be able to help you scale a lot of the non-value adding work that you had to do as an agency. So that is going to give you that amount of time. But I think you need to think about how you do that and how you can potentially save the client time. Because if the client is able to think more, believe me, you're also going to have some more time to think rather than just churning out work for the sake of doing work. So that's why I think that there's an important conversation to be had between both parties to say, okay, so how are we going to use this technology to get more out of this value chain for both of us?
Jess, does this talk about cognitive overload, that we are creating far too much work, a lot of it's by AI, and we are just overloading the customer, overloading the teams, our sort of internal teams at brand level, internal teams at agency level, and yet there's less and less quality work that's kind of getting out there. So from a marketer's perspective, how do you go against the grain by creating less work that's higher quality work without feeling as though you're being left behind?
Yeah, no, you know what, it's probably quite category specific. And I can appreciate that kind of my view on the use of AI and ABs are different because we're vastly different categories, right? And I think from where I stand, make less content. Ta-da! You know, but I can afford to say those things because, you know, a huge amount of my demand is met in physical infrastructure, in stores, in those kinds of things. It's not necessarily reliant on
click-throughs
and all sorts of things. So it's a very different context. We are always going to favor having far less, far better. We don't always get it right. We too run performance ads. Shock horror.
Yeah.
Not at a scale that a financial services I don't even know what hyper. I mean, I do know what hyper personalization is. It doesn't come across my desk because we're just in a different industry. So for us, it's going to be the craft over quantity. Mm. But because I am able to operate like that in the category in which I am, that's not to say it's a blanket approach for marketing. Certainly not, because there are some categories where you almost have no choice. Do I get irritated because it puts the cost up for everybody? Absolutely. The more rubbish we put out there, the more expensive it is for everybody to be able to be there. But again, it's just we have an approach and we have a history that shows that great, well-considered content, never mind your, you know, time limitations for YouTube, it doesn't matter. If it's good enough, people will watch it and they will seek it out. And that's always going to be the holy grail for us. But again, we come from a very different perspective and you know, way of operating than a financial services institute would.
Yeah, I mean, we've got no choice but to try as much as we can to make our work as distinctive. We just don't have as much money as our competitors.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's why, in a way, that's where Out of the Ordinary came from. That's where the zebra as an icon came from. In a sea of sameness, going with that type of icon has continued to stand us apart. But we don't have a choice. I also tell my teams all the time when budgets are being cut, because it's not just agency budgets that are being cut. Costs are being cut everywhere, right? It's do less, but just do it better. That's always going to be the challenge.
I think the thing that has come up in one of our conversations, I think it was the last conversation that we had, about when you put in a lot of effort, when you put in a lot of craft, a lot of quality, people feel it, right? I felt it in the recent Nando's ad. I feel it in the Investec work. Like, I can feel the efforts and the quality. And yet we've spoken about short-termism. We've spoken about churning out a lot of work. As a marketer, how do you stand your ground in those boardrooms and say, I don't think we should do more. I think we should focus on this and craft this piece of work a lot more and let it be more quality. So because people feel it in a world that tends to churn out more. How do you stand your ground? Like, what are some of the decisions and things that you have to take into those conversations?
I mean, we've got a real challenge in the sense that our share of voice relative to our market share is inverted. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, usually your market share should be matched somewhere thereabout with the share of voice that you've got. Your share of voice should match that market, that market share. Or your share of voice should at least be the ambition. I think bigger brands that, you know, are majority in the market can afford to have a share of voice that's a little bit less because they've got some sort of momentum benefit that they carry. Our business is on the same page with us. So they're saying, okay, we don't have the money to do everything that everybody is doing. So how do we do some really special stuff? You know, the Luxurious Marble Circus, I think, is a really good example of that is, you know, there are many sponsored music and lifestyle events that are costing competitors millions and millions and millions of euros and have been going for a very long time, and they're great. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we couldn't just go and do another jazz festival. Do you know what I mean? Like whatever we needed to put on needed to be something that was so distinctively Investec and with the right partners around you that it's unmistakable that is our brand that is investing that money. And we managed to do that. So how do we do that across, you know, even a simple banner ad is the challenge that we have for the team. Yeah. So I think our business is on the same side with us. They know we don't have the budget. We just need to have distinctive products, distinctive service, and distinctive marketing.
And you, Jess, how do you have those? How do you broach those conversations of better, more quality craft rather than just more for the sake of more?
So quite similarly, I'm quite well supported and sometimes stupidly so left to my own devices. But I think what is also important is that, you know, speaking about empathy, which is absolutely a key theme of this conversation, is that there are other members of the, you know, the executive team who have different priorities or different measurements in different languages. Most of it's in numbers, not words, which is something I'm not familiar with. But it's to make sure that you have a little bit of foresight to understand, well, how do I explain this potential outcome from marketing in a way that, you know, the head of supply chain can understand, the way the head of ops can, the finance person. I know there's always this thing, marketing and finance is always at war. I don't fight with my finance people. I love them. They pay my salary. I'm very nice to them. But it's because I think that there's a mutual understanding that I will come to you in a way that you understand so that I can show you in numbers what I mean. I will keep coming to you to show you how I'm measuring it so that you have a sense of ease that what I'm doing is right. And when it doesn't work, I will be the first person to stick my hand up and say, it didn't work. This is what we're going to do next. So it's just having an appreciation. Not everybody at that table is a marketer. So let's also not believe that they should all just, you know, blindly follow the marketing person who's often the most outspoken or, you know, vivacious or crazy person in the room. So just have a little bit of empathy. You know, these are humans. At the end of the day, we all want the business to succeed. Mm. It doesn't help if marketing, similarly, if people love Nando's for their TV ads, but not enough to come visit us, marketing hasn't done its job. You know, we've got to do it for the business.
I think this, what you guys are saying, is an example that you both have where your C-suite marketing is integrated into that. And that's always been a conversation, is how does marketing find a seat at the table and a voice at the table? And I'm very happy to hear that it seems like marketing has found a voice at the table. Yeah. And I guess that's also from your side. You have to put the work in. You can't just expect, like you say, the accountant, who is a numbers-driven person. Yeah. So marketing had to find a way to not be seen as a frivolous, just happy costume person, right?
Yeah.
There's some serious stuff going on there.
Yeah.
And I think you both are saying that that's happening in your organizations.
Mm. Yeah.
In evolution.
We're lucky. I mean, one of the things that we've come across is when people are using the same language and the same metrics and you understand the challenge in the same way, it makes the conversation easier. So we did a lot of work to help the business understand again what the brand stands for. Quite simply, these are the attributes of the brand. This is how it's going to stand out against the competition. That was important. Helping them understand how the conversion funnel works, like a very simple tool that says you go from awareness through the conversion, you're going to get clients that are actually your loyal clients. And how do you manage people through that funnel? Where do you spend money along that particular funnel? it's like magic for the accountants because they can actually see where the money is going and they can see how the conversion is working. So I think finding ways and a mechanism of a shared value and a shared understanding of the challenge and how you evaluate the work is really, really important. Just as we have to sit through and understand how the business operates and add value for that.
AB, we ask our guests to leave a question for our next guest. Think of it as someone passing the mic to you. And our previous guest was Lindy Lou Alexander, the CEO of WPP Open X Africa.
Uh-huh.
And the very easy question she left for you was, what's the marketing legacy that you'd like to be known for over the next 5 years? And how are you getting five people to help you live up to that legacy?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an easy question.
Yeah, trust Lindy to throw something that complex. Look, you know, for me, the most important thing is, you know, about being freshly consistent. You know, I think that getting back to basics, understanding the core of the craft and the core of your brand, and not getting bored with those very sometimes mundane, dull basics is a really important lesson for young marketers coming through today. So, yeah, I'd say, you know, don't try and be consistently fresh. Be freshly consistent is something I would like people to say when they talk about my tenure at Investec, and hopefully they follow up on that.
Now it's your turn to pass the mic to our next guest by leaving them a question about marketing, creativity, strategy, or building brands.
Yeah, I would say, you know, what is the biggest mistake that you've done? And what do you want to take out of that mistake to teach the people that come behind you?
Another very easy question for the next person.
This is as bad as my lie detector one.
Yeah, Jess, so it's also someone left you a question. I'll pass the mic to you.
I really hope it's not a doozy like that one. It's my favorite color.
Going deep.
What is my favorite color?
So Pareen Shah, the head of data and analytics at Roger Wilco, left you this question. What percentage of your work would you blindly give to AI without any human intervention? And to add to that, what parts of your work would you never hand over to AI?
So I've probably answered the second part. So I would never hand over creative generation to AI. I say never, but also never say never. Maybe next week I'll feel differently. But for now, generating creative thought, creative work, I would never hand over. I think there is likely, currently it's probably about 20% of my work that I'm happy to fob off to AI, summarize my emails, tell me which ones require a response, because also, as we know, we get CC'd on 600 emails.
Yeah.
But really, I don't care. You know, somebody's just passively, aggressively escalating somebody. I don't need to be, you know. So summarize my emails and let me know what's, you know, on my way to work. Quickly tell me what I need to respond to. Yes. So it's those kinds of things that don't require, I don't even, you know, I believe it when it says it's in my email inbox. But absolutely never at this point would I outsource creativity.
And most of the spam emails, the answer is no.
Yeah, well, it all goes to junk anyway, right? Yeah, auto filters into the junk.
Yeah, now it's your turn to leave a question for our next guest about strategy, marketing, creativity, or building brands.
So I think an interesting question would be what trend or cool thing do you think is way overhyped?
That's even deeper. Shame, good luck to them.
Really AI. No, I'm kidding. It's not AI.
Yeah, you don't want to answer that like the guy who said cell phones will never take off.
And then
10 years later.
Or exactly. Social media.
On record.
On record. Digital cameras, that'll never work.
No, thank you both so much for making time to join us. It was a huge, insightful conversation. We appreciate it.
It was fun. That went fast.
Thank you so much. That was awesome.
And with that, tell us who you'd like to see next. What are some of the topics you think we should cover? And please follow The Lead Creative on LinkedIn for more.